from WBUR Boston. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We grow up saving pennies with Abraham Lincoln's profile on them, memorizing his Gettysburg Address in high school, remembering him as Honest Abe. The nation's 16th president holds a special place in our hearts. But what if the assassination of Abraham Lincoln was unsuccessful? What if he survived, only to be taken down by members of his own party? Stephen Carter, legal scholar and best-selling novelist, brings Lincoln back from the brink of death and thrusts him into an impeachment trial. This hour on Point, Stephen Carter's alternative history of Honest Abe. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to reconsider Abraham Lincoln? Are you a fan of Stephen Carter's novels? You can comment on our website at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Stephen Carter, professor of law at Yale and a seasoned novelist. He's the author of The Emperor of Ocean Park and New England White. His latest novel is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln. You can find a short trailer for the book and a link to our excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Wade. I'm glad to be back.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Wade. Professor Carter, welcome.
Hi, Jack. A pleasure.
Stephen, I wondered if we could start by reading a few lines from your wonderful opening.
It would be my pleasure. April 14th through 16th, 1865. Turmoil. The president was dying. As the grim news spread through Washington City, angry crowds spilled into the cold, muddy night. Abraham Lincoln had been shot at Ford's Theater on 10th Street. The wounds were mortal, people were saying. There was no way he could survive. The war was over, the South utterly vanquished, yet somehow its withered hand had reached up into the nation's capital and extracted this bitter revenge. The crowds became mobs looking for somebody to hang. Some wanted to burn Ford's to the ground. Others marched toward Old Capitol Prison, where many leaders of the late rebellion were still being held. Outside Ford's Theater, a man in the blood-spattered uniform of an army major and a doctor carrying a candle fought their way into the street. A group bearing Lincoln's unmoving body followed behind. Mrs. Lincoln, face like chalk, clutched her husband's stiff hand. People leaned in, trying to see or touch. Men groaned. Women wept. A soldier banged on the door of a row house across the way. They carried the president inside and shut the door. People craned to peer in the windows. Those closest to the body passed on the story. The president's head was a mass of blood. That was Friday. By Saturday, however, the rumors began to change. Perhaps all was not lost. The doctors had cleaned the wound repeatedly and removed the clotting blood. And a miracle was occurring. The president's indomitable will was asserting itself. He had been shot on Good Friday. On Easter Sunday, he rose.
Stephen, the idea of saving the president is so delicious that it almost, you know, broke my heart. How did you – and it powers the book. How did you get this idea to save Abraham Lincoln?
The truth is that the idea of what might have happened had Lincoln lived has been in the back of my mind since a conversation in a history class when I was an undergraduate at Stanford, almost 40 years ago. And the idea of putting it into a novel, of then imagining not only his survival but building a kind of courtroom thriller around his impeachment trial – well, for me as a writer, it just became after a while irresistible. I can't say where it came from, but I had a lot of fun writing it.
I found myself shocked that the Senate would move to impeach a president. He's just won the war. He's a national hero. He survived an assassination attempt, which theoretically would make him even more beloved. I imagine him politically bulletproof. But I guess I'm looking at Lincoln through the lens of history, aren't I? Back in the real world of 1865, it's more complicated?
I have the same kind of, I guess, hero-worshipping attitude toward Lincoln as you and perhaps others do. I admire him enormously. But it is easy for us to miss that in his own party, he was never very popular. The Republican Party of the day, the big anti-slavery party, always saw him as this funny little Western fellow with a weird Kentucky accent and a high, reedy voice. He wasn't as well educated as they were. They thought he wasn't as moral as they were, not as committed to abolitionism, that he didn't win the war perhaps the way they wanted him to. He was always unpopular in his own party. And given the collapse of the economy in the years after the war, you could well imagine his popularity going into free fall, which has often happened to American leaders in the midst of the conclusion of wars.
I found it interesting that the radicals in the Senate are completely unconcerned about their own political fates as they go about the business of impeaching their president. They're not worried that this is going to somehow come back and bite them.
It's hard looking back to imagine this, but in the 1860s, members of the Senate were still very conscious of themselves as creatures of their states rather than of the people. They were sent to the Senate by their state legislatures, and their basic fealty was to the politicians, the political leaders in their own states. National parties were relatively weak, and the state governments, compared to the federal government, were very, very strong. And so you could go back to the Senate, be terribly unpopular in Washington, and be reelected again and again and again.
Abigail Canner is one of the most unique main characters I have come across in a while, and I understand she struck a chord with a lot of your readers. Tell us about her.
Well, Abigail was the protagonist I came up with after trying to figure out a way to tell the story from an outsider's perspective. There are a lot of novels about Lincoln, and almost all of them are told by Lincoln or by white men who are very close to him. I wanted an outsider, and Abigail is 21 years old. She's a woman. She's black. She's a free black woman, a graduate of what was then called the female department of the Oberlin Collegiate Institute. She's smart and she's ambitious and she wants to be a lawyer. This at a time when there are no female lawyers in the United States and perhaps half a dozen black ones.
Now, at first, I thought this improbable until I read more of what you had written about your writing this book. And you said, actually, no, not all that improbable.
It's interesting, you know, that a lot of people looking back just assume that all avenues must have been closed to black people and particularly black women at the time. And, of course, a lot of them were. But this is exactly the era when people were fighting through the first set of barriers. You had free black people, including free black women, going on into a number of different professions. Law was closed to women at the time, but it was not closed to black people. And so it was not that unusual that a black woman who was independent and smart and ambitious could have imagined herself as the first woman lawyer.
Jack, I know you're a student of history and a lover of the Civil War. Wanted to bring you into the conversation.
Well, you know, I think it's an imaginative coup to do counterfactual history, to ask us to ask the question, what if? Because really, that's the question we all ask. What difference do people make, individuals make? What difference does this timing make, chance? And here, I think, you know, Stephen, you talk about the resistance the radical Republicans had to Lincoln. The United States was on the point of a massive social revolution, which in some ways would have even exceeded the liberation of the slaves. That is, the parceling out, the confiscation of the land of the 77,000, according to Thad Stevens, slave plantation owners, the giving of that land to the slaves, and as W.E.B. Du Bois points out in his great book, Black Reconstruction, to poor whites as well, a social revolution on top of this great freedom struggle that would have secured some measure of economic independence for African Americans and poor whites alike. That was a golden moment. Both houses of Congress had passed confiscation bills. Lincoln was dubious, and I guess the question is, if he lived, could he have been persuaded? And if he could have been persuaded, the United States would have seen a different history.
Stephen, you've given yourself permission to rewrite history, and down this road parallel. How do you balance the freedom you give yourself when you rewrite history, and still stay true to history and keep your reader?
I think that's a great question. And to go back to Jack's point for a moment, Lincoln was very uneasy about the Confiscation Acts and about confiscations, of course, done before that by his military commanders. He always worried that it would break up the Union he was trying to restore. He might have been wrong about that. We don't know. But certainly he was uneasy, and so in that sense, the Congress was more radical than he. But just along that line, Wade, to your question, what I tried to do in writing a book like this is to exaggerate slightly the differences between Lincoln and the other radicals for the sake of a good story, because I want to make clear, I said before, I'm a great Lincoln fan. My book is called The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, but it's not a brief. I'm not saying Lincoln should have been impeached or that he would have been impeached. I'm only interested in what might it have looked like if he had been impeached and how to build an interesting and fun story around that.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We have Stephen Carter, author of The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, join us. I thought we might read another section. The novel's protagonist is the brilliant Abigail Canner, who I actually found to be a little Holmes-esque, as in Sherlock Holmes. She's a 21-year-old free black woman who graduated from Oberlin. She's a clerk in a law firm that's representing Lincoln in the impeachment proceedings. And in this scene, Abigail kind of first feels the sting of daily racism as she sees how the white men of the firm treat Mr. Little, who's the office's black servant.
Abigail stood for a moment, hand gripping the knob. She watched Mr. Little sweeping and watched the others ignore him. Her face burned. Rejection, exclusion, condescension. These were the price the nation daily exacted from the colored race, like a special tax on darkness.
The writing about race is something that you do in all of your novels. You seem to do it effortlessly. Talk to me a little bit about the art of writing about race, please.
It's not really effortless. In fact, it's often painful. I feel for my characters a lot. But one of the things I've tried to do here and in my other novels, even as I'm basically trying to write what are thrillers and mysteries, as you said, but at the same time, I often set them, at least part of them, in corners of black America that people don't pay much attention to. So here we have a young woman of the black middle class of the 1860s, and there are a lot of Americans who are scarcely aware that there was a black middle class in the 1860s, that there might have been families that were not only free, but had been free for generations. It's easy to see how we can miss that because of the larger crime that it was perpetrated against black America in slavery. But there were families like that. There were families whose children were educated, families that aspired to upward mobility. But even those families then, as occasionally now, faced these problems, rejection, exclusion, condescension, what I call in the novel the tax on darkness.
The book is actually a murder mystery. And so it goes on two tracks. We're impeaching Abraham Lincoln, and we're trying to find the murderer of one of the law firm's partners. And I find myself being pulled. I was annoyed every time I was pulled away from whatever track I was on, back to the other track. Then I would get involved in that track and be annoyed again when I was back into the murder mystery. How did you decide? Why did you decide to do it that way?
Well, I'm sorry if it was annoying. The idea was to write what amounts to a courtroom thriller about the impeachment trial and wrap that inside this larger mystery because in my world that I invent in the novel, it's not only Lincoln's political foes who are trying to removing from office. But there's also a sense, at least Abigail believes in it, that there's a larger conspiracy of some other sort of interest, perhaps moneyed interest, perhaps someone else, behind that. Hardly anyone believes her as she tries to track this down, but she is unwavering in her belief, in her commitment to discovering what lies behind the impeachment, who is there pulling the strings.
Well, I think my annoyance is a reflection of your success in pulling me into each of the tracks. And so I wanted to stay with it, but then when I got to the other one, I wanted to stay with that one. were you conscious of trying to balance the two, and was that part of the writing?
Well, the idea in writing a novel like this, when one's trying to tell multiple stories, is always to make each one of them interesting enough and powerful enough that the reader gets caught up in it. I think the trial, standing alone, is itself a fascinating story, just trying to imagine what the arguments would have been like, what the daily life of the courtroom would have been like. But then Abigail, of course, isn't directly involved in the trial. As a black woman, she couldn't be. She's an observer of it, and then also leads this other life of trying to figure out this conspiracy that almost no one else believes exists.
Let's take some callers, of which there are many. Paul is calling from North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Paul, hello.
Hello. Hi, Wade. And I must admit, I have not read any of Stephen's previous works or this work, but I, too, am annoyed simply at the fact of making fiction out of history. You could do this with anyone. You could say, well, what if JFK, had survived the head wound? Why is it necessary to use a well-known figure like Abraham Lincoln instead of some fictional character to write the book? It seems like it's almost rewriting history. There's already been a movie made that, Abraham Lincoln, the vampire hunter. Why is it necessary to do these kinds of things? Couldn't there be another fictional character that could take the place of Abraham Lincoln?
Stephen, does it hurt history to take it and do with it what you will?
Oh, I hope not. I am a bit of a history buff myself, and I use history extensively in the courses that I teach at Yale Law School. I think it's important to give history its due. In writing fiction and using real characters in the fiction, which is something that goes back pretty much as long as there's been fiction, it's not a new technique at all. We're also trying to explore and discover who we are. And in fact, it's interesting, Paul, that you mentioned the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter movie. We live in a moment where there's this enormous upsurge of interest in Lincoln, and a lot of it is fictional. There have been a lot of fictional accounts of Lincoln over the years, several hundred of them. And I think part of what's going on today, with the world seemingly so complex, their politics seemingly so broken and divided, that a lot of people, I think, look back looking for great giants in the past. And one of the things it's important to recognize about Lincoln or the other people we may admire from the past, admire with reason, is they're not giants. They're not better people than nowadays. They had weaknesses as well, and they struggled very hard with the hard decisions they had to make.
Jack, I'm a hopeless lover of historical fiction, but I thought I might have you weigh in on Paul's question.
Well, I respectfully disagree with him. I think it's important, as I say, and counterfactual history, which is sort of fiction, right? What if, and then staying with history, you imagine what would happen. That has really got a new respectability in the academy. Eminent historians, James McPherson, Neil Ferguson, others have written, specimens of it. What if the Archduke Ferdinand had not been assassinated and so on? What if the South had won the Civil War? And historians are taking that more seriously. It used to be, A.J.P. Taylor said, that isn't history, that's just fiction. Well, It's a way of it's hypothesizing. It's a way of thinking about history, and as I say, the Academy has given it a sanction lately.
Kurt is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Wade. I just I wanted to make a point about the premise, and it isn't as far fetched, I don't think, as it seems, because Johnson has seceded.
Nope. Are you still there?
I think.
Yeah, I think what he wanted to say was that he wonders if any president following the Civil War would have been impeached. Maybe not. Maybe it doesn't have so much to do with Lincoln as to do with the times.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to go quite that far. And it's interesting, if you go back 100 years, roughly, that is to the end of the 19th, the early 20th century, you can find a little battle among professional historians of the day about whether Lincoln, had he survived, would have suffered Johnson's fate and faced an impeachment trial. And a lot of historians thought he would have, that it was just the era and so on. But I'm not so sure. Lincoln was a man of extraordinary political gifts. And even though he might not have been quite as radical as the Congress in seeking in reconstructing the South, he might have been able to ward them off in a way that Johnson, who had poor political talents, could not. On the other hand, maybe not, because as I said, Lincoln was quite unpopular within his party, and with the economy tanking, he might have grown increasingly weak and unpopular as time goes on. Plus, in my story, he was also wounded by an assassin, and an attempted assassin has never been quite the same since then, and so he has that weakness to deal with as well.
Byron is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Byron, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering what would y'all speculate would be the effect on civil rights had Lincoln lived? Would there still be another 100-year deadline or timestamp on minorities receiving civil rights, or did he show any type of sign of moving more in towards that direction at the end of his life?
Now, this is the question, Stephen. What would Reconstruction under Lincoln have looked like?
I think that's a great question, and Lincoln put forth several different Reconstruction plans. He was always a little bit cagey about exactly what he wanted to do. There are certainly historians who believe that he would have kept to his constant pledge to let the South up easy, as he put it. But on the other hand, if Lincoln had lived and had seen not only the Black Codes but the other efforts in the 1860s to suppress the freedmen in the South, he might have wound up more in line with the radicals in his view toward the South. I think it's hard to tell if Lincoln alone would have made a big difference in the direction of civil rights, because the resistance was going to be massive no matter what was done. But it's certainly a great, if unanswerable, question.
Jack, would the South have fared better or worse under an Abraham Lincoln administration?
Well, if you define better meaning more just toward African Americans,
I guess we better define South.
Yeah. I mean, my thought is this: Andrew Johnson was a pathological racist. Frederick Douglass meeting with him and others just said that the man, you know, exuded discomfort just even talking to black leaders. And he pandered shamelessly to sort of democratic racism in his campaigns, in his speeches, and so on. And so to try to persuade that man to change policy, for example, not to veto the Freedmen's Bureau or something, not to veto the Civil Rights, impossible. I can imagine someone persuading Abraham Lincoln. On the testimony of Frederick Douglass, he was not a racist. He did not deal with African Americans as if they were another species. He dealt with them as if they were men. And I guess I would hope that he could have been persuaded. Now, of course, he'd been fighting the tide in the North, which, you know, what did the North not want? It didn't want African Americans coming into the North. And he might have even in his clever way been able to say, you know, if life is better for the ex-slave down there, they won't come up here. And that was a leitmotif. And he might have played on that in Northern prejudice to support a harder line against the South.
John is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. John, hello.
Hi, Wade. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Go ahead.
the comment you made at the beginning of the show is very interesting. And I'd like your guest to comment on this. I don't believe that we put Lincoln on a pedestal, but more so that we have a fascination with Lincoln, particularly because using the backdrop that he was president of the United States during the most crucial time to the survival of our nation. Here's a guy who was uneducated, who had a terrible relationship with his dad, didn't even go to his funeral, mother died early, had a rough marriage, was unsuccessful in his political life. As president, he's literally the last guy standing who wanted to save the Union. And despite all of that, he succeeds. And it's a classic American story. So I think it's more of a fascination of how the heck did this guy pull off everything that he pulled off and the time that he pulled it off, given the circumstances and the resources that he had.
Stephen, while you reimagined history, I found while reading the book, you didn't really reimagine Lincoln that much.
Well, I didn't reimagine him that much. Lincoln, although the book is called The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln, the story is probably much more about, in a sense, Abigail. Lincoln only shows up in 7 scenes in the book, and Abigail actually doesn't get to meet him until the second half of the story. But there is this debate among historians about Lincoln's, for lack of a better word, personality, which is quite an interesting one. So you still have historians today who see Lincoln as the great vacillator. You still have historians who see him as the kind of brilliant behind-the-scenes, outmaneuver the other side politico. I was most interested in the vision of Lincoln as the conspirator, and I mean conspiracy in a good sense here. I mean simply in the sense of working around other people's expectations to hold things together, and also the Lincoln who very much keeps his own counsel, as many of his friends said after he died, no one ever knows quite what he is thinking. Those are the aspects of Lincoln that most fascinated me.
But he was someone I recognized. When I saw in those few scenes where he appears in the book, he did not seem a stranger to me.
I used a lot of Lincoln's own words, obviously out of context, in constructing his words in the book. And where I didn't use his own words, I used things that I thought plausibly he could have said, given his other words and other occasions on similar subjects. I tried to create a Lincoln who'd be recognizable to the reader, even if he's a Lincoln whose mind we never quite can really read.
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're diving into Stephen Carter's recreation of tumultuous post-Civil War America. Joining us is Stephen Carter, Yale law professor, whose latest novel is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln. And we also have Jack Beatty, our news analyst. Let's take another caller. Carrie is from Springfield, Illinois. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Living in Springfield, Illinois, let me tell you one of the homes of Abraham Lincoln. I feel like a lot of people revisit Abraham Lincoln's assassination and kind of wonder, you know, what would happen had he not been assassinated. And, Springfield had actually, we just celebrated, celebrated isn't quite the word, we just marked the 100th anniversary 4 years ago of the 1908 race riots in Springfield, Illinois. And I almost wonder, had Lincoln in fact not been assassinated, had he survived his assassination attempt, or, what effect that would have had even locally in Springfield on the race riots, which then went on to trigger some other civil rights protests and movements. And I just think it's a fascinating subject to re-examine, what would have happened had he not died.
Stephen, the assassination froze the great man in time, but had he lived, would he be as revered?
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about a little bit before, where we can't know what would have been different. Something would have been different. And so, for example, We've been talking, we talked before about whether law would have been different, but now let's think about the black community for a moment. In my story, there is division in the black community over Lincoln as there is in the white community. Indeed, Abigail, my protagonist, while she is the clerk in the law firm that's defending Lincoln and is also defends him in conversation, her brother Michael, her younger brother, is a big radical. He wants to arm the freedmen and basically lead what amounts to a revolution even after the Civil War. And he despises Lincoln for his let-him-up-easy easy policy. I think those divisions in the community would have persisted as they've persisted to the present day over strategy and so on, no matter who was in charge of things. And I think, in fairness, while Lincoln surviving would have made some sorts of differences in our history, I don't think that we should ever think that one individual, even a man as great and talented and thoughtful as Lincoln, could have prevented somehow the great scars of race that have so divided and harmed the country and harmed black people over the decades.
Do you imagine he would have continued to run for president?
It's an interesting question also because during Lincoln's term, there were people who accused him of wanting to be president for life. It's important to remember that not until the 1950s was a constitutional amendment adopted limiting the president to 2 terms. And for a while, there was almost an unspoken thought that presidents shouldn't be reelected. And people, some people thought Lincoln shouldn't have run for a second term in 1864. I don't know what Lincoln would have done had he survived.
He was an ambitious man.
He was a very ambitious man, and he used to say that he always guessed he'd go back to being a railroad lawyer, but it's hard to imagine he could have done that. In those days, it was possible to go back from being president and become a senator or a member of Congress or something like that. It's difficult to imagine he would have left politics, and I could actually imagine him running for a third term in 1868.
I could too. Jonathan is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jonathan, welcome to the conversation. Jonathan, are you there?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Yes, you're quite welcome.
My comment is, I know that history. I feel as though history likes to look at President Lincoln as a compassionate figure, and I feel as though he's more of a true politician. Documents such as the Emancipation Proclamation, the language, how it did free slaves in the South, it left the option open for the Southern secessionist states to rejoin the Union and keep their slaves. I'm sure that was highly unlikely. Nobody elected that option. None of the Southern states elected that option.
No, I take your point. Did the Emancipation Proclamation, did Lincoln's motivation behind the Emancipation Proclamation play into this novel, Stephen?
There is some discussion of that in the novel. There is some discussion of Lincoln's views of slavery and how they evolved. And in fact, that becomes an important argument both between Abigail and her friends and also in the impeachment trial. I know there's a lot of people who have this view that Lincoln somehow was never seriously interested in ending slavery and so on. But one of the fascinating things about Lincoln is to look at his evolution in the White House. So you go from the man who in 1861 was willing to say he would, if he could, make peace without freeing any slaves to the man who in 1864, when the South sends peace feelers, makes very clear that he will not countenance peace on any platform that does not include a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. So Lincoln's own views changed dramatically over just the 3 years between 1861 and 1864.
Stephen, would you read from the impeachment trial? This is the radicals, the members of Lincoln's own Republican Party now. They were dead set on impeaching him for overstepping executive authority and also really being too soft on the South in their mind. And here's a scene from the opening statements of the trial.
Now Thaddeus Stevens rose. When he spoke, his voice was almost biblical in its rolling and thunderous power. There was no quaver. There was no doubt. He was speaking what his conscience told him was rock-bottom truth, and he would admit no differences of opinion. "Mr. Lincoln," he began, "is the greatest tyrant this nation has ever known, and given that he now commands the most formidable army on the face of the planet and uses it for his own purposes without regard for law or morality, he may be at this instant the greatest tyrant in the world."
Stephen, the radicals are somewhat annoyed at the way that Lincoln not only he conducted the peace, but conducted the war. I think they imagine they could have done it much better.
You know, in my story, there are four charges against Lincoln in the impeachment trial, and two of them, of course, are true. One, that he suspended habeas corpus and ignored court orders to release prisoners who were in federal custody. And then second, that he did indeed lock up some opposition reporters, journalists, that is, and editors, and shutter some newspapers. By opposition here, we don't mean partisan opposition. We mean opposition to the war. And also, which is a little less known, he allowed military commanders of the front, if journalists wrote stories the commanders thought were hurting the war effort, to subject those journalists to military courts-martial. Those things Lincoln did do, and he justified them because he said they were necessary to win the war. In my story, there are other charges as well, and among the charges against him are the claim that he did not has not enough to protect the freedmen, and ultimately a claim that he is, let us say, insufficiently respectful of the will of Congress generally, and indeed has tried to defy or perhaps override the authority of the Congress. That at least is the charge in his impeachment trial.
Let's take another caller. Christian is calling from Georgetown, Kentucky. Christian, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
It's our pleasure.
I just want to ask the author, what was it like reconstructing the political environment that would have sort of set the scene for Lincoln's impeachment?
I had a lot of fun doing it, actually, and not just the political environment. I do a lot of research for my novels, and this one, for the obvious reason that it's set in 1867, took more research than the others. I was very careful in trying to get Lincoln's voice right, the voice of other well-known men and women of the era right, but I also wanted to get not only the politics and the words right, I wanted to get the setting right. I worked hard at getting Washington, D.C. right. I wanted Abigail, my heroine, lives in a house on 10th Street in what was then called the Island, now called Southwest Washington. I wanted the view from her porch to be the view she really would have had from that porch if she'd lived at that address. The research, the efforts to get things like that correct were a lot of fun for me, not only as a novelist, but also as a history buff.
That you call Washington, D.C., Washington City, was that what it was called?
Some people did head by then started calling it Washington, but the official name was at that time still Washington City, and it was not uncommon for it to be called Washington City by those who lived there. Washington City in those days, by the way, being smaller than the District of Columbia, that is, there were a lot of neighborhoods now in Washington that in those days were the outskirts or the forests or where factories were or even very, very dangerous parts of the city, most famously Georgetown, which was, of course, a teeming slum in those days.
It was vividly reimagined. I felt it was almost a character in the book.
Well, I wanted the city to feel like a character in that sense. It certainly was for me. And because it's the story is told through Abigail's eyes and not through the eyes of someone very close to Lincoln, she's able to explore parts of the city and, of course, get into trouble and even danger in parts of the city where the great people of the city would never have gone.
Now,
but she has to go to those places to solve the mystery.
I found Abigail to be politely treated. I guess I kept waiting for some horrible scene where, you know, she would be taken down in a racist and rude way, but that really never happened. And is that – I wondered if I was mistaken to think that would be happening, or were people polite back then in a way that they stopped being?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by polite, and she has to suffer these everyday slights from the police officer at the Capitol who won't let her into the VIP gallery even though she has a signed pass. to the people who walk right at her on the sidewalk, forcing her to step aside or even into the street to avoid being being walked over, to the rule in those days that the back, ironically, the rear of the streetcars was reserved for white people. It wasn't a law, but it was a rule, an informal rule, and she follows it. So she faces all of those informal slights every day. And, of course, also lives with a constant fear, we're told in the story, as other black families do, that one night the Knight Riders, that is the Klan or the Knights of the White Camellia or some of the other groups, might come to her house. And so her family lives with a shotgun by the front door against that eventuality.
James is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. James, hello.
Hi, Wade. I just wanted to say thanks to the author for putting something out there that provokes thought, you know, asking the what ifs, like what if Kennedy lived, you know, what if he did go in the Bay of Pigs, you know, what if Washington decided to listen to everybody and become a dictator. You know, I wanted to throw that out there and support the idea and the thought. It's a great thing to have.
Thank you, James. Sam is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Sam, hello.
Hey, Wade. Great show. You know, listening to this program has caused me to reflect on the history of impeachments in our country. And it seems like it's a very peculiar history. I was wondering if the author reflected upon the times that presidents have been impeached and the times that they haven't. In my lifetime, I think of the picadillos of Bill Clinton, and in particular the fact that Richard Nixon was never impeached and lost a great opportunity for our country maybe to learn something about politics. And more recently, the fact that George Bush was never impeached for war crimes, and President Obama has not been impeached for extrajudicial murders and assassinations. And I was wondering what the author thinks about this peculiar history of impeachments.
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it peculiar, although I do take your point. One of the things that's fascinating about Lincoln compared to recent presidents, and we can forget this easily, Lincoln gathered into his hands far more authority than any president before or since. The only one who's close is FDR, and FDR isn't really close. And some people say, since you're calling from Massachusetts, so Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts told friends later that he opposed Lincoln on exactly that ground. He opposed Lincoln, worried about Lincoln, because the amount of power Lincoln had taken into his hands, he thought, was inconsistent with the leader of a constitutional republic. It felt too European to him, Lincoln's attitude toward power. A lot of presidents have done things that are wrong, either legally wrong or morally wrong. In fact, we can say in time of war, probably all of them have. And maybe one reason that we don't see impeachments over it is that people recognize, rightly or wrongly, there's something peculiar about wartime. The question in my book isn't whether Lincoln did things in war that were illegal. The question is whether he went too far.
Let's talk about another president from Illinois. This book marks a pivotal moment in history for African Americans, and the election of the current president marks another pivotal moment for African Americans. And Jack, I'd like for you to weigh in on this too. What are your thoughts about this particular moment in history?
I'm sorry, are you asking me or asking Jack? Oh, Jack, you go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, we're still living, it seems to me, with that question and how big the difference it's going to make in our history. I think it's just epic making that we have an African American president, and I think Abraham Lincoln would be proud.
I agree with that. And whatever happened in this election, if you'd asked people even 20 years ago if there would be a black president by 2008, they would have said, "Oh, come on, that's just silly." And I think, and when I say that, I don't mean they would have said it because they opposed it. They just thought it wouldn't have been it wouldn't have been possible. In that sense, it's truly a wonderful thing. It's also the case, and a lot of people have asked me about this concerning the novel. The nation is very divided right now. People ask me, "Is it divided the way it was in the 1860s?" No, it isn't. We fought a war in the 1860s. It's very different, but we do have these deep and enduring divisions. And I really, really hope that President Obama might be the one who finds a way to mend that divide.
Jack, thanks so much for riding along with us today. It's always great to have you.
Thank you very much.
And Stephen, it's been a pleasure. Congratulations on your new book, and thank you for joining us.
been my pleasure. Thanks for having me back.
Stevens Carter, latest novel is The Impeachment of Abraham Lincoln. You can find a short trailer for the book and a link to an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. There you can also continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.